I'm going to recap the very thing that I spoke on last time, and I'm going to run through a few things. And just by chance that some of you weren't here, I need to go back over that so that I can get into what I want to talk about tonight. But I'll spend a good amount of time recapping what I talked about last time. And one of the things we need to continue dismantling is the idea that that our transformation begins in the place of our behavior. That behavior modification is the starting place of our transformation. I think that's a horrendous way to live. I've come, and I'm going to talk a lot more about behavior. I don't in any way want to say that our behavior is not an important aspect of our transformation, but we need to understand that our behavior needs to be the outcome, not the pursuit, not the goal. And this is something that the Lord's kind of got me. Every once in a while, he'll kind of introduce me to a new way of thinking, and all of a sudden, like, everything in life becomes filtered through this thing. And right now, what the Lord's got me thinking about is the difference between goals and outcomes. Because there are a lot of things that we're meant to have, we're meant to be, we're meant to do that are good things, they're godly, they're holy, but they're meant to be the product of an outcome, not necessarily the goal itself. So let me give you a few examples. So Katie and I have been married for like 9.5 years. So thumbs up from Katie. Just shy of half of 2 decades. Some of you guys are like, what? So about 9.5 years, and we, you guys are like, wait, care of the four, subtract. And one of the things that we really enjoy about our marriage is that we just don't fight. We're not a couple that fights, and we both really like that. But I'm going to tell you that not fighting in marriage is a terrible goal to have. It's a beautiful outcome, but it's a terrible goal. Because if my goal in my marriage is not to fight, what will I be justified in doing to achieve that goal? We'll become really conflict-avoidant people. We'll become really passive. We'll sweep everything under the rug, right? Any kind of conflict, sweep it under the rug. Ah, happy family, we're not fighting. No, nothing to see here, right? It's a terrible goal, but I wonder if there's a more excellent goal. Maybe the goal of loving each other well, serving each other well, communicating often and directly. And those kinds of things are things that we've put in place, and as a result, we don't fight. It's a terrible goal, but it's a beautiful outcome of a more excellent goal. Another thing the Lord's got me thinking about in terms of goals and outcomes is money, finances, which is something that I feel like the Lord, no matter what season I'm in or what he's talking to me about, there's always this kind of like behind the scenes, like back of my mind, he's always talking to me about money. And it's so interesting. I've got a bunch of new thoughts on finances. I'm not going to get into that tonight, maybe another time. But one of the things I've come to realize is that having money is a great outcome, but it's a terrible goal to have. Again, because our goals will justify the means of achieving those goals. And so if it's my goal in life to see how much money I can get, what will I be justified in doing? It may come at the expense of my family, time with them. I may, you know, I think we could think of all kinds of things that we would do. But does that make sense? Having money is great. Have money. You've got it, great. But don't let that be the goal. Let that be the outcome of a more excellent goal. I'll give you one more. Some of you have heard me say this before. But in parenting, if you're a parent, you want obedient kids. That's how it goes. I've never met a parent who doesn't want obedient kids, right? Never met one. But obedience for Nora, for Isabel, is a beautiful outcome, but it's a horrendous goal for me to pursue. Because the thing is I know I'm not big and scary to you guys, but to them I could be if I wanted to be. And so if Nora wasn't doing what I wanted her to do, it would be really easy for me to get her to do what I want her to do by use of fear, intimidation, manipulation. And I would be achieving my goal, but then you have to ask the question, well, if I scare her into doing what I want, is she actually obeying me or is she just trying to survive me in that moment? And so again, obedience is a beautiful outcome of a place of love and connection, but it's a terrible goal. Okay, and it's the same thing with our behavior in terms of our gospel transformation, this process of our transformation that the Lord is bringing us through. If it's our goal to behave a certain way, the starting place is already at fault. It's a faulty starting place, and it will never take us to where the Lord intends us to be. So last time I was here, I talked about, I love a good whiteboard reveal, by the way, the flip, like, what's it going to be? Last time, is this good? A good angle for everybody? I want to make sure everybody can see this. I talked about this process of beholding, becoming, believing, and behaving. Behold, become, believe, behave. And I've got a few verses. If you're taking notes, I'm going to read these. So 2 Corinthians 3:18 says, "And we all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another." Next is becoming. 2 Corinthians 5:21 says, "For our sake he made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God." Romans 12:2, "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind," by renewing what it is that we believe and how we think. And Ephesians 5:1 says, "Therefore be imitators of God as beloved children." Be imitators. In other words, look at what he does and go do that. Now, here is what the church has done a fantastic job at doing. Because the kingdom works like this. Your process of transformation and becoming the person that you were called and created to be is meant to begin with beholding the Father, coming to him, sitting in his presence, looking at him, discovering as much truth as we possibly can about his nature, his character, what is he really like, how does he think, what does he believe. And in the process of beholding him, we become the righteousness of God. So in beholding, or should I say believing in him, we become like him, in that we become the very righteousness of God. And if you are not familiar with what we've been teaching about righteousness, the best way I've heard it said, Noah said this a long time ago, he said that to have become the righteousness of God means that to the same degree that he is who he's meant to be, you are who you're meant to be. It means that you are whole, you are new, you are everything. Everything that was meant to be in you from the beginning that was robbed has been restored to you fully. That's what it means to be righteous. So when we behold him, we become like him. Now, here is what religion does, and this is awesome. That was really sarcastic, by the way. Religion totally reverse engineers the whole process. And religion says, don't worry about beholding. Because first of all, religion will say that if you're saved, you've gotten a ticket to heaven. But until you die, you've got this really angry God who's looking to punish you. Thankfully, we have Jesus as a mediator. He is the nice guy between us and this angry father. And so if you want to be somebody who is worthy of sitting in the presence of God, you've got to start here and you've got to get your act together. And it begins here. And religion will say, if you can get your behavior together, then you will have become somebody who is worthy of beholding him. And the thing about starting with behavior is that you might be able to temporarily, on a short-term basis, manufacture something somewhat of like a fabricated outward transformation. There's an analogy maybe you've heard me use before. Let's say you bought a house and you're excited, you move in, fall comes in the backyard, or spring, whenever this would happen. You're in the backyard and you realize that one of your trees is an apple tree. You didn't know that when you bought the house, but now you've moved in. You don't know anything about trees. Now you're like, oh my gosh, there's an apple tree. But here's the problem. You hate apples. Not only do you hate apples, you are embarrassed to have apples growing in your backyard. You don't want your friends to know. You don't want your family to know. And so what you do is you come up with this idea. You think, I know. I'm going to go out there, and I'm going to pick off every apple as it comes. I'm going to pick it off. I'm going to throw it away. I'll throw it over the fence. It'll be my neighbor's problem. Whatever I'm going to do, I'm going to pick all the apples off. And that way, what apple tree? It's just a regular tree, guys. No apples. No apples here. But then, of course, next year, there you are. You found a great short-term solution to your problem. But if you really don't want apples, you're going to have to find the root that's producing those apples and dig it up and replace it with something that will produce a different fruit. Now, the thing about fruit, I'll say this, is that behavior is the fruit of belief. In other words, whatever you believe is going to manifest itself in your life in the way that you speak and the way that you act. And so when religion works this way, religion is not too worried about the belief, right? Because, religion doesn't really like a lot of questions. Just kind of agree with me, do what you're told, shut up, and we'll all be okay, right? Religion will say, think how I think or go somewhere else. And that's why denominations have become what they've become. Anyways, behavior is the fruit of belief. So our beliefs are what's justifying our behavior. So how often have we been taught in a religious system that in order to be somebody who is worthy of sitting in the presence of God, to come to him, to pray to him, to talk to him, to engage with him in worship, you first have to get this in order, your behavior. But the crazy thing is that we have such a disconnect between behavior and becoming. Because another thing that religion has taught us is that who you've become is synonymous with how you behave. But what the Lord does is he draws a line down the middle here, and he says, this is where I am, and this is where you are. You aren't defined by this. This is important, but this is not the sum total of who you are. Because when the Father looks at you, he sees this. And what it is that you've become is that you've become righteous, and you've become new, and you've become whole, and you are completely forgiven, 100%. So the Father looks at you, and he says, this is who I see. But when you often look in the mirror, what you see is this. And we tell ourselves, well, I must not have become this because I don't act like it. And the thing we need to remind ourselves continuously of is that the thing that separates who we've become and how we behave is what we believe. And that is the thing that I think the Lord is trying really hard to get us to understand, is that he thinks a certain way. And until we think the way he thinks, until we believe what he believes, this is not going to be the same as this. But the more time we can spend dialoguing with the Father, pursuing him, sitting with him, asking questions, getting in the Word, discovering the truth of what he's like. What, Father, what do you believe? What do you see when you look at me? How do you think about me? How do you think about this? How do you think about that? As we get this in order, and get this in alignment, our beliefs with him and with his kingdom, the behavior will be a natural product of that. So we shouldn't be necessarily living our entire lives thinking, how do I do what Jesus did? But if we get to the point where we just think, Father, I just want to be with you, and I just want to know who you say I am. And once we get that in place, I want to propose that this will happen naturally. You won't have to think or work hard at being a good Christian, but Christ will just flow through you. I'm going to apologize for the noise that this water bottle makes when I drink from it. I'll try to avoid it, but it's a lot. If you've got your Bibles, you can turn to Romans 10. I'm going to read verses 1 through 4. Romans 10, 1 through 4. I'm reading in the ESV right now. And the context here is that Paul, if you finish chapter 9, Paul is talking about Israel. But he gets into chapter 10. And he says, "Brothers, my heart's desire and prayer to God for them is that they may be saved. For I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge." Okay, listen to this. "For being ignorant of the righteousness of God and seeking to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness." Okay, I'm going to read that again, because to me, this is like where I see so many people at in life. "For being ignorant of the righteousness of God," right? Ignorant means you don't know what you don't know, right? If I'm ignorant of righteousness, it means that I don't know what it means to be righteous, but I also maybe don't even know that I should be wondering what it means to be righteous. "For being ignorant of the righteousness of God and seeking to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes." So when we are ignorant of the righteousness of God, what happens? There is a natural attempt to establish our own version of righteousness. And every attempt to manufacture your own version of righteousness is going to start here, and that is a failing system 100% of the time. Thank you. But every single time, an effort to establish and manufacture our own righteousness will be done by the law. Now, here's why that stinks, okay? The law was great for revealing sin, but it does not have the power to remove sin. And that's why Jesus is so desperately trying to get us to come out from the umbrella of the law, to come under the umbrella of grace, because it is only when we are standing in grace, as Paul says in Romans 6:14, that sin will have no dominion over you, for we are not under the law, but we are under grace. But we want so badly to keep a little bit of law mixed in with our gospel. It's like we love grace, but also, like, I kind of want to work for this thing too. You know, I kind of want to have something to show for who I've become. And it's hard. It's a hard shift to make, eradicating any bit of law from our gospel and from this gospel transformation. It's really hard to do that. But once we do, if we can come to a place where we eradicate law from our soteriology, from the gospel message, from all of that, and we can come fully to the place where we are standing under grace, then I don't think there's a person in this room, maybe in the world, who has actually maybe conceived of the fullness of what that could be, what that could do for a person. I'm going to read, there are two verses that I really love, because we need to believe the truth about who we've become, who the Father is, who he says we are, right? And I found this. This is Psalm 103. I don't know what verse it is. I just know it's in Psalm 103. He says, David says of the Lord, he says, he does not deal with us according to our sins, nor repay us according to our iniquity. Okay? He does not deal with you according to your sin, and he doesn't repay you according to your iniquity. I think that's something that's hard to believe. And that's hard to believe too, because like even as a parent, there's just a part of me that wants to be this like law governing, driven, like focused on behavior. And it's really hard to even break that cycle as a parent. But the Lord doesn't deal with us according to our sin. And if you back up in Psalms, back to Psalm 18, verse 20, David says that he has dealt with me according to my righteousness. He doesn't deal with you according to your sin. He deals with you according to your righteousness. In other words, he doesn't deal with you on the basis of what's happening over here, though this is important, and we'll get there again later. I've got more I want to say about that. But this is not the starting place for how he sees you and how he deals with you. It always starts with him right here. It always starts with the idea that if you have believed in him and you've beheld him, then you have become everything that you need. Everything that you need has been given to you. Everything has been deposited. Also in Psalm 103, David says that, he says, for as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his steadfast love toward those who fear him. And as far as the east is from the west, so far does he remove our transgressions from us. Romans 3:20 says, for by works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight, since through the law comes knowledge of sin. Being justified and being made right in his sight, it can't come through the law. But what does come through the law is knowledge of sin. As I said before, but here's the thing, is that sin consciousness is the product that we've gotten out of a pursuit of this law-driven, performance-oriented, self-effort-based gospel. Right? The product of that is sin consciousness. And that's why people are so obsessed with the behavior thing. Because we are so conscious, we've become so conscious of our sin, that in some ways I think that has robbed us of being conscious of who the Father really is and who he really says that we are. So I'm going to change things up a bit. I like finding as many ways as I can to say the same thing, because I find that it helps me look at the same picture from a different angle. And so we're going to do this. Where up until now I have said, behold, become, believe, behave. Let's talk about it like this. Believe in. Become like. Believe like. Become as. Okay, believe in him. When you believe in him, you become like him. But it's not until we believe like him that we will be as Jesus was in the world. Because John said in 1 John 4:17 that as he is, so are we in the world. But again, it's hard to believe that. Because we're like, wait a minute. He was like this, and I'm like this. He acted a certain way, and I act a certain way, but he's over there, and I'm over here, and I can work really hard at behavior modification to try to get myself to look like him, but that doesn't ever, ever work, right? How have any of you tried through behavior modification to overcome something, to change something? It's like I can fight really hard. Maybe I want to eat differently, right? Maybe it's not anything crazy. I just want to eat healthier. And so a lot of times we think, okay, starting tomorrow, starting today, I'm going to start eating healthier. I'm not going to eat fast food anymore. I'm going to do this. And then it's like, well, we're coming up on the weekend. So Monday we'll start, right? And then maybe on Monday, maybe you do start. And maybe it's like, I'm doing great. Monday, nailed it. Tuesday, I did so good on Monday. I'm going to give myself a little treat on Tuesday. But then Wednesday, I'm right back in. And right, and we do this game where it's like, you're trying so hard to manufacture this transformation. But I wonder what would happen if we just took a minute to stop and think, well, what am I believing about myself that's producing this behavior in the first place? Because the behavior is a byproduct of something else. So if I can figure out what am I believing and what am I thinking that's producing that unwanted behavior in the first place, and I wonder if I deal with that and plant a new belief there, all of a sudden there will be a new behavior that I don't really have to work at. It's just the natural byproduct of having a different way of thinking and believing. As he is, so are we in the world. The thing is, we could get really weird about how Jesus was in the world. I mean, what did he do? He walked on water. He multiplied the food when people were hungry. Post-resurrection, he walked right through a wall to say hey to his buddies. He walked right through the wall. The thing about Jesus is he had no regard for the physics of this world. Just no regard for it. In the story in Luke 24, the road to Emmaus. You familiar with that story? Post-resurrection again, he's walking, I don't remember how long it was. It was miles, like it was a journey. He's walking with two of his disciples. They don't recognize him. They think he's just some guy, and on the whole way, he's like revealing scripture to them, and he's like giving them revelation, just blowing their minds. They get to where they're going, and at that point, it's late and it's dark, and he's like, well, I'm going to keep going on my journey. Nice to meet you guys. And they're like, well, stay with us for the night. It's late. You don't need to go travel by yourself. Stay with us. We're about to order some Domino's. We've got a movie. Hang out for a bit. And he's like, okay, I will. So they sit down. They have dinner. He breaks the bread. They give him some bread. He breaks it. He looks up to heaven, and he does what he does. He breaks the bread, and he looks up to heaven, and he blesses it, right? And he thanks the Father. And in that moment, their eyes were opened, and they realized that they spent a whole day with their friend, and they didn't even somehow, I wish I knew why, but they just didn't know until that moment. And I think, I imagine that he was so playful in that moment. And if you read, it says that once their eyes were opened and they realized who it was, it says he just vanished from their sight. I imagine he gave like a little eyebrow pump and was like, see you guys, and just boom, gone. Right? He did such bizarre things. He healed every sick person he prayed for. He cast out demons. He raised the dead. Sometimes I read the Bible and I think, what? Like, how is it that the Father seems so sure that we are meant and called, and not only that, but are actually capable of being Jesus' representation, that we are actually able to do what he did? And I think last week Noah said this. I think it's meant to be that because the people didn't, for forever, everybody had an incorrect view of the Father, right? And I imagine what Jesus, what that was like for Jesus as not just a kid, but like a teenager, and then he's in his 20s. It's like every week he's going to temple and thinking, this is bad. You guys don't get this at all, do you? And then finally, he's 30 and he's released to reveal to people what the Father's actually like, because nobody ever had comprehended the reality that the Father is so good and he is so loving and he is so kind. And even when people, his disciples would say, Jesus, would you show us the Father? And he's like, no, guys, you still don't get it. If you've seen me, you have seen him. I've heard it said that Jesus Christ is perfect theology. Everything that we need to know about the character and the heart of the Father is seen in Jesus. And what Noah said last week is, I think we're meant to come to a place where we can look, where people can look at us and say, if I've seen them, I've seen the Father. That's actually what we're called to. We're called to be his representatives. We're called to be ambassadors of the Father and of his kingdom. And I don't know if this is an oversimplification. I don't think it is. But I'm proposing that if we're meant to be healing every sick person we pray for, if we're meant to be raising people from the dead, if we're meant to be walking on water, walking through walls, if we're meant to be so in tune with the kingdom of heaven that we start to lose regard for the physics of this world, if that's who we're meant to be, I don't think this is an oversimplification, but I want to propose that the thing that's preventing us from doing that is just incorrect belief. Because if belief produces behavior, how can I behave in a way that is inconsistent with how I believe? And so I think that if we can continue getting our belief in order, if we can continue looking to the Father and saying, what do you believe about me? What do you believe about the world? What do you believe about this situation? What do you believe about that? And we learn to actually take his word for it and allow our beliefs to be overwritten by his truth. I think the natural byproduct is that the world is going to see a generation of people that has never been seen before. I'm confident that there's never been a generation of people who have believed, truly, fully believed in the gospel and in what it means to be righteous and what it means to be holy. Noah and I joke all the time that what we hope happens is that our kids grow up and their understanding of righteousness and holiness is so extreme that they look at us and they're like, you guys are morons. You didn't get this stuff? Like, you really had to preach this thing over and over and over and over and over again? Like, you weren't just doing this stuff? And I hope I have to be like, yeah, I didn't get it. But I think that there are going to be generations of people coming who are going to be raised up that have such a profound understanding of what it actually means to be seated in heavenly places with Christ. What it actually means to be living in a place of mutual indwelling, where we are in Christ and he is in us. And that I think there's going to be generations of people coming who truly, people look at them and they say, I have seen the Father. I have seen the full measure of what it actually means to be transformed by the gospel. Because our inward transformation is activated through belief in him. And you may have heard me say this before, and I think about the Israelites every time I talk about this, but believing in him and believing like him aren't the same thing. And if they were the same thing, then they wouldn't have wandered in the desert for 40 years. Because it was actually a 2-week journey from Egypt to the Promised Land. It was meant to take them 2 weeks. But when they got there, they were like, I know, Moses, that the Lord said, this is ours, but I don't think so. And so for 40 years, they wandered around. And what's interesting is that there's actually a verse that says, it says, and every one of the Lord's promises to Israel had been fulfilled. Every single promise that the Lord had made to Israel had been fulfilled. But here's the kicker, is that not all of the Israelites got to experience the fulfillment of the Lord's promise. And I want to propose the thing that can delay his promises being manifested in our lives is incorrect belief. Is this clear? Tell me no. Don't humor me. If there's something that's like, I don't know what you're talking about, tell me. This is, you know, I've been interested in the topics of righteousness and holiness for years now, for a long time. And it's almost becoming so overwhelming. I was telling Noah yesterday, I almost want to be like, I'm done. Our kids can figure this out. Because it seems like there's so much of what I thought was true about the gospel, about salvation, about what it means to be righteous and holy. And it's like the further I go into this thing, the more I realize I don't know what's going on anymore. All I know is that I think there's a lot more available than what I'm experiencing. I think the Father will always be even better than I give him credit for. I think there's more to being righteous. I know that there's more to being righteous than I currently understand. There's more to being holy than I currently understand. That's what I know for sure. But there's a part of me that's like, Nora will get this. I'm going to sit back for a few years. I'm going to disappear. Nora can figure this out when she grows up. But at the same time, I feel there is such an invitation that the Lord is extending to the church right now. Such an invitation to discover a greater measure of what it really means to be saved, what it really means to be whole and to be righteous, what it really means to know that I right now and you are seated in heavenly places. I go home and I'm like, I don't know what to do with that. I know that it's true, but I don't know what to do about that. I know that the Bible says that right now we have full access to who the Father is and to all that he has. And again, I go home and I'm like, I know that's true, but what? I don't know what to do about that. But I figure if we keep preaching this stuff long enough, someone will get it. So it might be me, it might not be, it might be you, I hope so. But I really don't, I mean, apart from Jesus, the world has never seen what it looks like when a person really gets this. Of course, he got it, and we saw what happens because he got it. And it's easy to think too, like, well, he was God's son, so he was kind of like, he was kind of set up for success in that way. Yeah, but also like the invitation is there. And I think he is so, so excited at the prospect, the possibility that we might be moving into greater levels of really believing like he believes. Because once we believe like him, the rest is easy. And it's hard, too, that it's hard to dissect and understand the different parts of us. Because there's like, you know, there's a, the term is like a bipartite versus a tripartite. theology in that, like, are we just body and spirit, and the spirit and the soul are the same thing? Or some people are like, well, there's the body and the soul and the spirit, and they're all different, and like different things become new at different times, and different things, parts have different functions. It's like, it's a lot to think about. But the only thing I know for sure is that the part of us that did not become completely renewed in an instant when we were saved is our mind. And I think that's important, because if I automatically thought exactly like Jesus, there wouldn't necessarily be room for trust or faith anymore. Because trust and faith, they exist in this tension. This is where they exist. If I, without that tension, because, you know, faith is believing in what you haven't seen. And the beautiful result of faith is that you get to see what you believed. I know for sure that my mind was not completely made new. But I also know that when the Father looks at me, he sees the finished work of Christ in me. And that's a really mysterious thing. It's really hard to grasp the fullness of that concept, that when he looks at me, he sees one thing. When I think about me, it's something else. And how do I bridge those? How do I get those things together? I wonder if we've become so sin conscious that we've really, say, downgraded the levels of dreams that we could be dreaming with the Father. Noah and I talk, and I think we should be like exploring the cosmos and solving like really tremendous, like solving real problems here, right? Just through like heavenly revelation. But instead, you know, we get caught up on such little things, and I think what we have access to is like I think it's coming. The days are coming where maybe it's us. I think it could be us. Maybe it's the next generation. But we're going to see people raised up who will walk into a hospital, maybe walk right through the wall and heal every single person in there and walk out through the wall. Nobody even knows who it was. All they know is the doctors are out of a job. I think there is so much for us to take part in. And we are going to chip away little by little for as long as we have to until what we know is possible becomes our actual reality. Because right now I'm dreaming about what it would look like to walk through a hospital and see every single person healed. But I think the day is coming where that's not going to be a dream, it's just the reality. It's just how it is. We're so sure of who we are and of what it means to be seated in heavenly places right now that I could just walk through the wall right there and walk up and go to the hospital and say, you're healed, you're healed, you're healed, you're healed, and it's done. I'm going to end, but I'm going to ask you to just sit with me for a little while. And we're just going to sit for a few minutes. If you have to go, you're blessed to go. I love you. Braden, would you come up? And Katie, would you come up here? And if you're on the prayer team, if you could be available for prayer, if you need prayer, don't leave here without getting it. But I don't want you guys to just come and hear me talk for however long I've talked, but I want to extend to you an opportunity to sit here in a room in the presence of God and actually engage with him in this matter. And so Katie's going to sing a little bit. Braden's going to play. Again, if you have to go, whenever you want to go, I release you to go. But if you can, just for a little bit, let's just sit and let's just engage with the Lord. Look at him, talk to him. Come and sit at his feet and ask him to reveal more truth about his nature, to reveal more truth about who you are. If you want to come sit here at the altar, great. If you want to stay in your seat, great. If you want to walk around, if you want to stand in the back, whatever you want to do. I bless you and I release you to leave if you have to. But if you have time, let's just hang out for a little bit and let's just sit with the Father. And let's try to get a different perspective from him about who he is and about who it is that he says.